run by our Human Science Research Council, that is the HSRC. I think what's going to be important is for us to introduce ourselves before we start for the meeting formally. And I'll do it in the order where the members will introduce themselves. Then it will be our core staff. And from there, we'll go to the HSRC. And then we'll speak about the process of the meeting. Thank you for the introduction. Honourable member, right next to me.
Good morning, Chair. I'm sorry to be caught me munching something. My name is Alfred Bojane, a member of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, everyone. My name is Nomalinga Magina. I'm also the member of this committee. Thanks.
Good morning, everybody. I happen to be silent, my friend.
My name is Crosby Morning Toba.
Good morning, all. My name is Annette Lovemore, also a member of this committee.
Good morning. My name is Donald Smiles. I'm a member of this committee.
Good morning. My name is Fonny Florence, 19 Gay Michelle. And I'm also a member of this committee.
Tawela, I'm Mashishi AC, local committee. Hello.
Good morning. My name is Dennis Bandy, content advisor for the committee.
Sorry, Chair. Morning. My name is Ilwan Mahaga, researcher for the committee. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm a little late. Sherilyn Buzzy, member of the committee.
Good morning, Reverend Brown, committee secretary for the committee.
Thank you for that. I think we introduced everyone that's our core staff. Oh, there's the one person.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Goldie Nuskosana, committee assistant.
Thanks a lot for that. We'll introduce yourself, and then the team can introduce themselves too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm Vijay Reddy, the executive director of the Education and Skills Development Research Program. Just for clarity, Chair, the HSRC had led a consortium of members to undertake this research, so we come from different institutions as well.
George Grimbaum from HSRC.
Dick Taylor from Chair Education Services.
Sakani Chaka from the Center for Education Policy Development and the EPC.
My name is Ivor Bartu. I'm from the Center for Education Policy and Transformation.
Just turn the mic because it's being recorded.
Sorry, my name is Ivor Barches. I'm from the Centre for Education, Rights and Transformation at the University of Johannesburg.
Neville Alexander from the Project for the Study of Alternative Education South Africa from UCT.
Molweni, my name is Godisa Gozula from PRISA.
Molweni, Ntomzanele Maobe from PRISA.
Thank you. And then we have visitors usually every week. Will you introduce yourself?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Shifra. I'm from the PMG, that's the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Good morning. Christian Fischer, Textbook Development Institute.
Good morning. My name is Bernard. I'm from the Parliamentary.
Thanks for those introductions. We are going to have the team that's with us this morning. But the person came in last.
I'm Shana Porta from the Human Science Research Council.
Fine, thank you. you going to remain where you are? yes, Ms. Bradley?
Sorry, just to say that I have to slip out in about 50 minutes time to another meeting, so please, my apologies now. I'll slip out quietly. Thanks.
Fine, thank you. Any apologies, Loella?
Yes, thank you, Michelle. Apologies has been received from Honorable Skosana as well as Honorable Jacobo.
Just noted. I think this morning you've speaked now, really. We have four presentations. Because as you heard at the beginning, this is a team that's here with the HSRC. So we're going to give each team 15 minutes to speak. We'll listen. And everyone note their questions. Then after we have the four presentations, we are going to interrogate the report we are receiving. And then I'd like to say too that it was a bit difficult to put you in, because I think you requested us last year already to have you, but we thought we have to have you, you know, in this term, because what you're going to speak to us about is very important when it comes to education itself. Because as you know, when it comes to our aneurysms, that it's not something, although it's a diagnostic tool, it's not something to speak about, because our children were very weak when it came to our learners' literacy and numeracy. And we know it is challenging within schools. I'll hand over to you, Ms. Reddy. Then you decide, you know, who's first, who's going to be second, who's going to be third, who's going to be fourth. Because we're going to use half an hour to question you, and we're going to allow you half an hour to reply. Thank you. Yes?
Sorry, just to be clear, the presentation on the screen is not in, we don't have it in our packs. What we do have is the report, and I just wondered if there are copies of that presentation. Makes a lot easier.
Thanks, Honorable Lovemore. We are receiving this presentation now. But I think it would have been really much more better if we received it, you know, before the meeting, like last week, for example. Thank you.
Portfolio committee and members of the portfolio committee. As a starting point, I would like to say, or we would like to thank you for making time in your agenda to accommodate us as researchers presenting the findings of a massive research project that we have undertaken. We appreciate that. Just as a point of 2 minutes of background, in 2006, a number of research institutes came together to put together a proposal around, a research proposal around the issue of improving the quality of education in South Africa, with particular emphasis on literacy and numeracy. The institutions being PRAISA, the Education Policy Consortium, Joint Educational Trust, and the HSRC, the Human Sciences Research Council. They formed a consortium, and this consortium took the research proposal to the Royal Netherlands Embassy, who then provided funding for a comprehensive study of this issue. And this research was undertaken from 2006 and ended in December last year. So it was a five-year study. The funding from the RNE allowed the institutions to undertake longer studies, panel studies, etc., in a way that we couldn't do so before. When we came to the end of the studies, we thought it's appropriate to report and to engage with the portfolio committee around the findings, and hence the request from us. The research program objective was around knowledge advancement, research capacity, policy knowledge and strategies, and institutional and community support. And those broad program objectives define the activities of each of the consortium members. And for this morning, what we will do, four institutions will present on these, a bit of their research. It's not going to be the whole thing. We have submitted the synthesis report that was circulated. I think what we also submitted previously was the PowerPoint presentations from individual institutions. And we, for the PowerPoint, the printout that you have now is of all the PowerPoint presentations that have been put together, and we tried to cut it down a bit so that it fits into one hour. So you have an elaborate set of presentations, and then the more edited set of presentations for now. And the synthesis report gives you more details, and we also set up a website for this project. It's called the 3Rs project: reading, writing, and arithmetic. So www.3rs.org.za. And so the research report of all the consortium members will be found at that website, and you can find it off the HSRC website as well. And in terms of the presentation, the Education Policy Consortium will present first, and there's two presenters. Then that will be followed by the HSRC, the Joint Educational Trust, and PRAISA. There's quite a few slides here, and while we have the full presentation, I think each of the presenters will talk to the main issues and then take up issues in discussion, so that we are good and try to keep within the 15 minutes that for each institution that you've allocated us. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, ma'am. We're looking at, I think it will be the UN Science Research Council.
Sorry,
it will put on, then we're quite sure. Education Policy Consortium, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to speak to one of the projects of the EPC and the broader consortium, which is called the Community Literacy and Numeracy Group Research Project. We just call it the CLIM project, which is really concerned about and trying to understand the effects of community participation in communities and its effect on the literacy and numeracy of children. This particular project, the key principle around which it is centered is the principle of participation. And the argument is that without participation, the development of active citizenship and a substantive democracy is not possible. And key to that is literacy, improving the literacy levels of children in schools, and colleagues you know as well as I do, or even sometimes better, that we have a serious problem with literacy levels amongst our children, and this is evident from the assessments that have been done at grade 3 and grade 6. So what this project tried to do is to work with communities and to get communities to be mobilized and to embark on a number of different actions in order to attempt to contribute to literacy levels within communities. And this comes in light of dwindling participation of communities in the life of schools, and secondly, the issue of low levels of literacy in classes that has numbers of children up to 70 no libraries and so on, very poor support in many of our rural schools and so on. So what we have done is we've worked with activists, young activists within communities, and we embarked on a participatory form of research where we involved these young unemployed youth mainly in collective construction of the research. For example, we've conducted community mapping exercises where the EPC researchers provided support and leadership, but to help communities to do research, basic research, which they have actually done. And this project took place in three provinces in a total of five sites. It was in the Eastern Cape, Limpopo, and in Gauteng. And I worked very specifically in Gauteng in the two communities known as Freedom Park and Everton North. What we have found is that communities have agency and activism, and there's a great importance and attachment to the value of education in these communities. And through that, the communities have mobilized mainly youth in these communities to support literacy activities. For example, these young people have managed to establish, for example, a shack library in Everton North. And this shack library has been used in the afternoons to support children with their schoolwork. Early childhood development has been used to, programs have been used to support children with just with reading and writing. There are many other examples. Some of the youth have been running Saturday classes in schools where they supported young children with their homework. There were many other examples, and more recently has been the implementation of reading clubs. Some of these communities have done remarkable work in how they have built relationships with school principals, for example. Yet at this time, one of the school principals is exploring the possibility of setting up a library at his school where the ratio is 1 to 65. There's no library in the community. There's absolutely no support. But yet these principals have welcomed the work of CLING. And the Gauteng Department of Education is in the process of appointing six community workers who will work specifically with reading clubs to mobilize support. And this reading club idea is linked to the work that Neville and Tracer staff has been doing, and it's part of a new reading campaign called the Nali Bali campaign, which you will hear more of. But I only have, I think, 3 minutes left.
One minute.
Okay, so let me just tell you that what are some of the recommendations that I would like to emphasize. The first one is that community participation in education has been undervalued, but it remains extremely important. And therefore, there's a need for government to think very, very urgently about how they support this kind of work. And I think the Gauteng Department of Education has given us one example, although it's not policy. They've taken the step to support this kind of work. But this is not enough. We're going to need a few thousand of community workers to support education in these communities. Secondly, universities themselves they talk about community engagement, but they talk about a particular kind of community engagement. And what we would like to emphasize through this research project is that there's a need for much greater support to universities to put community engagement where there's serious social engagement between researchers and universities and communities. That kind of work is important. And lastly, Vijay, what is very important is to recognize the agency and the activism that exist within communities, and that communities have the power to make a change. They can change, they can contribute to school reform, and in order for them to be effective is simply to give recognition to this kind of work and support them to carry out the work. Thank you.
Thank you. The second study that the EPC undertook focused on the issue of multi-grade classes, and in particular we wanted to look at the issue of literacy and numeracy practices in those schools. And we also wanted to get a sense of what the extent of multi-grade teaching is in the whole system. As we may recall, in 2005, the Department of the Ministry of Education released a report on the on rural education, which indicated that among the many challenges that are facing rural schools is that of multi-grade teaching. And this was a follow-up on that process. How we went about the study is we looked at, we analyzed the data that is available in the IMIS directory to look at the issue of the extent of multi-grade classes. And then we also did a 6 case study in the Northwest Province, where we interviewed principals, teachers, and also did some observations in the classrooms. In addition to that, we interviewed provincial and district officials, as well as teacher training institutions. Our key findings from that is that, you know, in terms of the extent of multi-grade classes, is that about 27% of our schools are in fact multi-grade schools, or they have multi-grade classes. Although, you know, this actually served by about 7% of the teachers. And in terms of learner numbers, we've got about, the proportion of learners is about 0.4. And 0.4% of learners. I think I'm getting my steps wrong. It's actually 4% of the learners in the whole system. In terms of the teaching practice, when we looked at the whole issue of teaching practices, we found out that, in fact, the whole multi-grade issue is neglected in the system. And that was evident in the fact that there's no policy currently that talks to the issue of multi-grade teaching. There's no recognition that this this exists in terms of, I mean, officially. Although there have been some activities on the side, particularly undertaken by the Rural Education Directorate, which has now been closed down, which began to look into this issue. But officially, there's nothing that says we've got these schools in our system and this is how we're going to go about supporting them. In addition to that, there's no specific support to multi-grade teachers in schools. These teachers are supported just like any other school. So, you know, it's because our system obviously is geared towards monograde classes, monograde schools, and doesn't give specific attention to the fact that these particular schools need specific support based on their context and the needs that they have. There's also the issue of, you know, requirements. You know, like planning and assessment requirements, they are the same across, with the result that multi-grade classes end up being burdened with the amount of planning and assessment that they have to do, because then they have to plan for multiple classes, unlike your monograde class for teacher, who may have to who plan for single grade. And then, as a result of the fact that there's no support for these schools and teachers, given that the attitude towards multi-grade teaching is actually negative. In fact, most of the teachers are just waiting to get an opportunity to jump out of the situations they are in, because they don't have the necessary support that they should be getting. In terms of recommendations, I'll just talk to a few of the key ones, which actually sort of hold the rest together. And maybe it's necessary for multi-grade classes and teachers to be supported. And the first recommendation is that of a need for the development of a multi-grade education framework, policy framework. And this will sort of guide, you know, how then these schools are resourced and supported. And linked to that is the need to have a plan of action that will be more specific around, you know, what needs to be done. And the next one is we're calling for the reinstatement of the Rural Education Directorate, because we feel that will allow for this issue to be put on the spotlight, to be given the attention that it requires. And you know, the 4 years that the Rural Education Directorate was in existence, we believe it was beginning to achieve something around you know, giving the focus to rural schools and multi-grade schools in particular. But now, with the fact that it has been closed down, there seems to be no unit that is focusing on this issue, and it's like we're taking a step backwards. There are also other recommendations that talk to the need for teacher training programs, both at pre-service and in-service phase, to actually also look into multi-grade teaching, the training of multi-grade teachers, because currently they are just left to their own devices. They are not prepared on how they should teach in such settings. So, I don't know how I'm doing in terms of that. Okay, next. In fact, it's just a list of recommendations, and the other issues that of learning materials that need to be appropriate for multi-grade teaching. Given that usually a multi-grade teacher might have to give assigned work to the rest of the learners while he or she focuses on a particular group. So we believe that appropriate materials that allow for self-study would be the way to go. And we are recommending that those materials be made available, be developed and be made available. The issue of district officials also. We feel they need to be prepared to be able to provide support to multi-grade teachers, because currently the situation is such that multi-grade teachers have to actually, you know, do it themselves, and you know, and some of the district officials, for example, will say, look, we don't know how to support you. And I, you know, there's that frustration also amongst them. It's not that they don't want to support these teachers, but the point is that they don't know how. And we believe that if they could be given the necessary support, the necessary training, that will assist them in their work and also in the work of the teachers, which may lead to quality education. Thank you so much.
Now the HSR still research look at assessment and how assessment can enhance teaching and learning. We all know that for the past decade, there have been a lot of changes in education, moving from education that catered for a small minority to education that catered for almost every child. And there's also changes in the way teachers conduct teaching and learning in classrooms, from teacher-centered to let us say the approaches of learning. And this has also led to, I mean, changes in assessment. So instead of assessment of learning, we have assessment for learning. Instead of assessment, summative assessment and accountability, we have assessment for diagnostic purposes. So there's been a lot of changes. And we see that, I mean, these changes have created a lot of challenges for the whole system and also for teachers. So the HSRC study explored the changes in using assessment to enhance teaching and learning at the systemic and classroom levels. And we asked the question, what does the systemic evaluation tell us about the provision of quality education for all? What challenges are teachers and district education systems encountering in their attempts to use assessment to improve teaching and learning? And we also wanted to find out how these challenges can be addressed. We had three main studies. The National Assessment Study of Learning is published in 2009. We also looked at the district assessment system and then teacher classroom assessment practices. For the National Assessment COVID-9, we collected data from COVID-9 learners across the 9 provinces on their achievement levels and their learning characteristics. And this involved about 9,000 learners from 300 schools. And then with the district assessment system, we looked at case studies in Gauteng and Western Cape using individual and focus group interviews and observation. And we also had reviews and some assessment documents to have an understanding of how curriculum and assessment units function within these provinces. And with the teacher classroom assessment practices, we look at case studies in eight schools in Gauteng, Mpumalanga, and Lobwe, using questionnaires, interviews, and lesson observations, and also document reviews. And these are some of our main findings. I mean, with the National Assessment of Learning Achievement, as expected, most of our kids, we found that most of our kids are not doing well. In language, for instance, a typical Vietnam learner was performing at LNT level, which is about 50%. And in math, an average student had a score below 30%, which is not achieved level. But we also found out that most of our learners, from the Polish homes, also attended Polish schools, so most of them in Peter 1 and Peter 2. But what is most stressful is that, the few of these learners who attend the most resourceful schools, the Peter 5 schools, are also not doing so well. I think about 3% of them do not meet the required standards, which is quite depressing. And this particular graph shows what is really going on. What we did was, because we collected data on student background characteristics, I was able to develop a scale for poverty, or what it calls socioeconomic status. And I grouped them into, just like we did with the 5-point, the way we group our schools, Quinta 1 to Quinta 5. So I did the same thing for our learners. So we have Quinta 1, what poverty, the school poverty quintile, home poverty quintile 1 to 5. The home poverty quintile 1, meaning that the kids from the poorest homes, and then those in quintile 5 are those from the least poor homes. And if you see, we have the bars, the group of bars represents the quintiles. This is quintile. Okay. This is quintile 1. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then if you look at the bars, it's clearly shown. And again, before we go on, the scale. We also scale the achievement scores in such a way that 0 represents the average score. Okay, so the scores range from -10 -2 to look at the Prince Awards schools, the kids from poor families are really not doing well. I mean, the kids from the rich families are doing better than those from poor families. They compare the blue and then the yellow bars. The same thing with quintile 2, quintile 3, quintile 4, and quintile 5. But if you look at the gap between the rich, those from the rich kids and the poor kids, especially in quintile 5, it's very, very wide. And most seriously, you see that the blue one in quintile 5, the bar is below zero, which means that they are performing below average, and they're not even doing better than those in quintile 3 and 4.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The argument that many people buy resources to this case will help them to do well. We need to think through that argument, because I mean, simply providing these resources to the schools and saying that the kids go to the schools and therefore do well may not necessarily be true. So we need to provide support to some of these kids, including our 5 schools. And then with the assessment at the provincial and district level, we also observe that there's similar difference in the way that the two provinces conceptualize the curriculum and assessment implementation processes. You have in one province, the processes are separate, while in other, the curriculum and assessment units are integrated. And we also observe that the teachers seems to have greater challenges in integrating curriculum and assessment in the province where the two units are not integrated. So when the school units are not speaking to each other, there seems to be a problem in the schools with the teachers integrating curriculum and assessment. And then with the teacher classroom assessment practices, we also observe that, the teachers have a very limited understanding of how to use assessment to enhance teaching and learning. They predominantly use the strategies of awarding marks and giving motivational comments instead of having a deep diagnosis of what the problems the kids and children are actually encountering. And in most cases, the attempt to comply with assessment policy demands, instead of having a very deep understanding of the underlying assumptions of the theory of action of these policies. So how do we address these challenges? We have got some recommendations as researchers, we always do that. We suggested that the current targeted interventions where the five has students, poor students can have excluded, are actually missing the poor learners in these schools who actually need help. And I think we need to reconsider that. Again, improve resources to schools without understanding of how these resources work to improve learning would not be enough. I mean, simply giving kids resources, that's not necessarily mean that they are going to be successful in schools. We need to do more than that. We also need to develop an understanding of the conditions. There are some kids who are poor kids in very poor schools who are also doing well, and I think we need to get a better understanding of how these kids are able to do well in very poor schools, and maybe that will help us develop better policies for improving education system. Mm-hmm. And I think education is also without education, I don't think the nation can move forward in terms of development and employment and all those things. So we need to mobilize the public. We should all be involved in trying to help our kids to learn. Develop what I call the hunger of learning for success. We need to encourage that. Among committees and all stakeholders. We also need to think outside the box. We can use technology. The technology is everywhere now, and we're thinking of the use of telephones. If you have kids, poor kids who go to school, and their only source of knowledge is their teacher, the teacher is failing them, the school is failing them, I think we have to think of another means of providing learning materials to these kids. And we're thinking of the use of cell phones. We budget has got a lot of infrastructure development. I think we need to give something to these poor kids so that they can have something in the school and the community school, and they can also use it, at least have control of what they do. And then with the district assessment system, I think, as I said, there's a need for integrate the curriculum and then assessment. The two of them need to talk together if they are to perform their function effectively. And then with the classroom assessment practices, we also think that there's a need for professional development. Apart from the ones that teachers have, we also think that we need to think of professional development within schools. If teachers within schools can help so that have teachers from other schools come who are doing so well come to their schools and help the things through the things they can do to help them. We also think again that we can use technology to help teachers to use assessment to enhance learning. We developed a computerized assessment system with a lot of items and also a diagnostic function. Okay, that helps teachers to diagnose what is the problems with their kids and also provide feedback and those kind of things. And I think those kind of instruments can gain insights about learning strengths and weaknesses. We can also identify relevant strategies for addressing learner needs and monitor learner performance continuously. And this is a tool that is developed with our department. We can create a class list, generators, mark tests, has also reports that teachers can use to enhance the assessment practices. In fact, we've written a proposal to USAID and they are going to give us money to extend this system to the foundation phase. We met them on Friday. We also be looking for funding to extend it to. The USAID funding will only support reading, so we also be looking for funding that will help us to improve numeracy. Okay, thank you.
Colleagues, we called JET's component of this project the National School Effectiveness Study. So if it comes up. It's an enormous study. It's the first nationally sampled longitudinal study in the history of school research in South Africa. We worked with 268 schools selected at random across the country, stratified by province. The only province that got left out was Gauteng, because when we did our first round of data collection, they were doing a provincial assessment, and we didn't want to interfere with that. So unfortunately, Gauteng got left off. Each year, we followed these kids from grade 3 in 2007 into grade 4 in 2008 and into grade 5. So we actually could get the gain scores for each year and relate those gain scores to what their teachers were doing in the classroom. Because, you can't just say a learner's score is due to the teacher he's got now. In grade 3, the learner's score is due to all the teachers he's ever had in his life, including his mother and father and everyone at home. So longitudinal studies are incredibly important so that you can get the gain score and relate that to what's happening this year in the classroom. Each year, we had about 16,000 kids in the study, but at the end, we tracked 8,383 through all 3 years. We looked at an enormous amount of data. We looked at home educational practices. We looked at school management. We looked at classroom practices. And we looked even at what the districts are doing. Guys, this is an enormous study. It's a book length. The final report is a book that I handed to the publisher on Monday. So I'm not even going to try and go into any one of the chapters in detail. What I want to do is just pick up on one number, and it's in the bottom right hand corner of that table. Colleagues, we're sick of scare stories. We know how bad our schools are. I want to get from this bad situation in the rest of my talk. I want to get to how what I think we should be doing to fix things. But I just want to start with this number, 3.6. That is the average number of paragraph length pieces of writing a grade 5 child does in South Africa in 1 year. In other words, they write a paragraph about once every quarter. Now you'll see the provincial breakdowns there. In the Western Cape it's about twice a quarter, 7.6. In the Eastern Cape it's about twice a year, 2.3. Now we're talking about paragraphs, colleagues, and paragraphs are incredibly important. Let me give you an example of one from a grade 1 child from the Transkei. Now, you know, we know about kids from the rural areas flooding into our cities. But you know, it's not just our cities, it's the towns all over the country. This was done in Plettenberg Bay. We did some work in Plettenberg Bay a couple of years ago. And you know, from 1 year to the next, you can see the number of Xhosa kids in all the schools growing. They're just swelling. They are coming down, it's like a Ho Chi Minh trail from the Transkei. They stop along the way, and most of them end up in Cape Town. And of course, Gauteng, and even Bloemfontein, you know, all over the place. They're going from our rural areas. Now, this child is from the Eastern Cape. Now, remember, in the Eastern Cape, they're doing about 2 pieces of paragraph writing a year. And they mostly do single words or just isolated sentences when they're writing class. It's very, very seldom that we get paragraph length writing. But colleagues, I want to show you this. Umama Wam, a grade 1 child from the Transkei in a Plettenberg Bay school where we were doing a development project. So this was a reading and writing program. And that's why these children can write so well. But just look at this wonderful story about my mother who eats food, who sleeps, who fetches water, who cuts with a knife, and at the end she eats a lovely sweet pear. Can you see how writing develops the expressive qualities, the descriptive qualities, the analytical qualities of children? If you're just writing words or sentences, you are not developing those higher skills where you're planning a thing, you're putting thoughts together, you're getting grammar to make it all work together, you're fitting the words in. It's all a complex cognitive process to write that. And we're not doing it. We're doing it on average once a term in our schools. So this is the big tragedy of South Africa. Colleagues, and why I'm thinking on this is because it's actually relatively easy to set targets in terms of standards of writing for each grade and the number of times they should write. My own view is they should write something like that once a week in every lesson, in every class, in every subject, and that they should be writing and reading every day. Now, colleagues, how do we get from that situation there to this one, where even the poorest children, you know, you go into these classes, it's a tragedy. It breaks my heart every time I do it, because there these kids sit. They are capable of doing that, and at the end of grade 6, they still often can't write their names. You know, you give these kids a test, and you see them struggling with that contents page, writing their name in grade 6. When they're capable of that in grade 1, what is the blockage? Colleagues, in a word, it's our teachers. It's not their fault. That's how they've been brought up. That's how they've been educated. That's what they think school is. But how do we get them now to speed up? And as I say, I'm not going to go through this mountain of data that we have. I just want to speculate in answer to my own question. I want to say, you've got to build a professional civil service. You see, the thing is, teachers who can't do their maths, and we looked at teacher knowledge, and we found that the majority of teachers in South Africa can't answer a simple ratio problem. We found also that teachers are not teaching ratio. Well, it figures, doesn't it? We found, now this is the most interesting finding, I think, of our whole study, that only when a teacher can do ratio very, very well to the to the level of grade 10, in other words, using graphs and using equations and calculating, can they explain ratio properly to their children? We've got to take teachers to a high level of knowledge in their subject. But now let me get back to the civil service. So that teacher who can't teach ratio, who can't do ratio, so he can't teach it, gets promoted to a head of department. Can't help any of the teachers. Gets promoted to a principal. Even more can't help any of the teachers. Gets promoted to the district. Can't help anyone. Now, colleagues, isn't it a wonder that Sato refuses to have these people in classrooms? I sympathize with Sato, actually. And you know, in deference to my to the honourable member from Cope, I started off this project with an animus towards Sato. At the end of it, my conclusion is that Sato is not the problem. The problem is weak, incompetent civil service that the unions take advantage of, on one hand, and they protect teachers against, on the other. The answer is not to slash Sato. The answer is to strengthen the civil service. Now let's go back to that math teacher who doesn't know her ratio. What are we going to do about that? Well, colleagues, I think there are two things. If you look at my diagram there, and by the way, in 2010 we spent 1.1 billion rand on in-service training for teachers. So now they're all qualified, but they're incompetent. The lesson is, teacher training doesn't take a couple of afternoons a week to get you to understand ratio to the grade 10 level. It's going to take a lot more than that. The most important place to start is on the right-hand side with beginning teachers, with initial teacher training. We've got to see what's coming out of our universities. Do they know their maths? Do those primary school teachers know their maths to the level of grade 10, at least, if not grade 12? I don't think they do, actually. And that's where our problem starts. So, and it's quite easy, by the way, to test whether they do that. Give them a test. We can, you know, we've got qualifications, but we can also have competence tests. We can also say, look, entry into the teaching profession depends on you passing this test. And a lot of other things. I would say they should know the curriculum backwards as well. How many hours a week are we supposed to spend on maths in grade 4? Teachers should know that. They should know that curriculum backwards. So what I'm saying is we must start setting competence standards. We must start setting competence tests for entry into the profession. We can do the same for promotion. How can we promote someone to head of department if he can't do ratio? How's he going to help anyone? Why are we paying him more to be as incompetent as he was as a teacher? So we've got to set standards for promotion, colleagues, and we've got to promote people according to objective standards. And they're actually really easy to test. I mean, a principal should have been a very successful head of department, first of all. A principal should know the Labour Relations Act, or that part that pertains to teachers. A principal should know parts of the PFMA, etc., etc. And all of these things you can test. When they apply for a job in the district, well, now you've got to know even more. And we can set all of those competence standards, and we can train to achieve those. Colleagues, this is what I mean by building a professional civil service. I'm very pleased to see that in the NPC, the National Planning Commission's report, they're recommending building a professional civil service. And colleagues in education, that's what this means for me. Thank you.
I'm going to dispense with the pictures. Colleagues, friends, I just want to say that in the project for the study for alternative education in South Africa, PRISA, we took as our point of departure that we don't need to prove certain things. We know what the problems are, but we should focus on what needs to be done, how to do things. So that was our starting point. We also took as a starting point that certain things need band-aid, need short-term fixing, because we need to help the kids and the teachers who are currently having problems. But longer term transformational strategies need to be introduced, and our partners have to some extent spoken about some of those issues, whether it's assessment, teacher education, professional development, and so on, multi-grade classrooms. And our findings, our recommendations complement what they have come up with to a very large extent. Now, introducing transformational long-term strategies is something that requires a long-term vision. You've got to know, you've got to have some idea of where you want to be in 20 to 30 years' time. And I just want to give one single example of one of the central issues that we looked at, namely the basis of language medium policy. We have in South Africa an English medium-based policy. With the exception of for the first 3 years at school, in most cases, with that exception, all teaching allegedly takes place in English, which is a common language to most of our children. Now that is a fundamental reason why we are failing. It's not the only one, as so many of my colleagues have already said. But it's a fundamental reason. So if in 20, 30 years' time you want to reposition things, you want to put the educational system, place it on the basis of the mother tongues of the children, then you've got to initiate that process gradually in a very systematic way. And this is part and parcel of what we were looking at. How do you do that? What do you have to do in the classroom in order to change it? How does that affect literacy, learning, and so on? I'm not going to bother you with the theories. I'm taking for granted that afterwards colleagues will have a chance to read these things in more detail. A lot of the stuff will be on the website in the next few weeks, including some of the data sets that we've produced. Most of our work was qualitative, case study, action research, and so on and so forth. I won't go into those technical details. So to take that example, as I say, of mother tongue-based education, and just to show you the complexity, we are very clear that because of Bantu education, you cannot sell mother tongue education to black people in South Africa. You can't. People think you're selling Bantu education. And that is the reason why we've insisted that what we are busy with, and what my colleagues will speak to in a moment, what we are busy with is mother tongue-based bilingual or multilingual education. In other words, our children must come out of primary school knowing both the mother tongue and English equally well, or as well as they can under the circumstances. They've got to know both of them. And knowing a language doesn't mean speaking and understanding. It means reading and writing. Without the ability to read and write a language, you actually don't know it in the modern world. You can't empower yourself. So this is the important point to understand. We concentrated on four schools in the Western Cape, but we worked with other groups in the Eastern Cape, more particularly in Karkastad, Lizana, Kanduli, East London, Zimbaza, etc., as well as in the Northern Cape, in Upington. We worked with various other groups, as I say, but our focus was on these four schools, which are typical schools, and with some adaptation, the findings and the recommendations that emerged from our study can be adapted to virtually every other school, because these are, as I say, typical township schools and one very urban, semi-rural school. I'm going to ask my colleague, Ntombizanele Mahobe, to speak briefly about the issue of early literacy, as well as interactive writing with children.
Our intervention to whole language approach in schools show that children love reading and writing letters and using interactive journal writing when they have role models. And for us, this was not a surprise. We knew that was going to happen. However, we found inconsistency among teachers in making stories central in children's learning and in creating meaningful opportunities for writing. Children loaned books from us and also from the libraries and also from when the schools had a library. And this was something that was not happening before our intervention. By grade 3, children could read in both English and in IsiXhosa, unlike before where they were only taught English in grade 3, and that was only orally. Again, children are now doing extensive writing in different genres, including letters and journal writing, which gives opportunities for children to write in meaningful ways, as opposed to when teachers dictate writing for children, as opposed to just filling sounds and letters, which is something that normally happens in most of our schools. The use of songs allow children to practice their English in non-threatening ways and in also environments where children can engage with text meaningfully. Now, this intervention carried on into our communities, community reading clubs, which showed that children who were attending their reading clubs changed their literacy habits and attitudes when it comes to reading and writing. Now, what are our recommendations when it comes to reading and writing? We're saying that smaller classes encourage better implementation of any reading and writing strategy. We're saying that not only foundation phase teachers, but teachers need training to understand how children learn, and that emphasis needs to be on meaning rather than, that emphasis needs to be on meaningful learning. And when it comes to interactive writing, we found that interactive writing to be an excellent tool for getting children to write more and to get children to read. And that we need to bring communities into our schools, and because this is another way of helping adults and helping adults into our classrooms. When it regards to materials, we need to bring districts and to offer more workshops. And also when it comes to second language, we say that the department needs to train English first additional languages specialist. Yes. Thank you very much.
Well, I think I'm going to talk to what Nick was saying about teacher professional development. We found that teachers do have certificates and diplomas that show that they are qualified teachers. But when you get to the classroom, their practice doesn't match the qualifications they have. Mm-hmm. So it means that they haven't understood what they need to implement. Mm-hmm. And it means that they haven't been shown what they need to do. So what we found was that mentoring teachers was a successful way of training teachers away from colleges and universities. So when we went into schools and became team teachers with the teachers, working together, we showed the teachers what good practice means. We didn't tell them that if you do this, we didn't give them papers to say go and do this. But we showed them, because we also understand that some of our teachers didn't come from what you would call good schools. They are products of these functional schools themselves, and they have been products of poor education training in the past. So if you want them to produce the best, we believe that you have to show people what the best is. So we became team teachers with them. We did demonstration lessons and classes. They taught, we taught, and we reflected on our practice. So one of the most important things that are central in teacher professional development is reflective practice. Because reflective practice allows teachers to find solutions to their own problems instead of saying, okay, there are no books, I'm going to fold my hands. They have to think of ways of how to bring books into the classroom, of how to improve their own teaching approaches in the classroom. So in order, therefore, for teachers to take up everything that we were showing them, we found that it was important that we were there on site all the time. They needed to be to see us and to work with us, to plan with us, to teach with us in the classroom. Because without that happening, then there's no way of knowing that they are really doing what you give them on paper. And it serves to them as a reminder that, you know, I need to do this, I need to do this. But the most important part about that is that we needed to go there with an attitude, a particular attitude. An attitude that says to teachers, we are not here to inspect you. We are here to help to empower you. And you are here also to teach us things about the classrooms.
So we were in it together. We were never pinpointing fingers to say, you are the problem. We said, this is our problem. Children are not reading. How are we going to help them read? Then we reflected and we put plans in place to say, okay, if these children are not reading, we're going to start maybe a literacy half hour in the classroom, and then we're going to read to the kids every day. If it doesn't work, we reflect again and say, what didn't work in our practice? And then we found solutions for those, and we came up with new solutions and new plans. So for us, therefore, we felt that that doesn't happen enough. Teachers don't get mentors in schools to mentor them and to show them and to train them. But we know once we did that, the teachers became very empowered to do the stuff that was being asked of them. In fact, we helped them to understand the curriculum better. And it worked in a way, if we came with interventions, those interventions to tally with the government, with the Department of Education curriculum and policies. So we helped them to think through, what medium am I teaching in? When do I code switch? When do I not code switch? When do we plan for English lessons? When do we plan for TOSA? What do we do in the curriculum? And that worked for us. But when we were going to be away and not be in touch with the teachers on site, we used journal writing, interactive journal writing with the teachers. So it became a tool for learning for the teachers. We had a book, a notebook, where the teacher would reflect and then would write to me, and we would, and other colleagues as well. And then we would write back to explain the things that maybe were misunderstood when we reflected together in the classroom. And the book therefore served to reinforce some of the things that we planned to do. It explained some of the things that people weren't clear about. And then we kept this book as like a letter, you know, in a book, and we were writing to each other all the time. And in that way, we're able to offer information that the teachers needed to understand. We were able to answer the questions and concerns that they had, and they were able to tell us where the problems are, and together we found solution in the journal. So, therefore, but we found that if another most important thing was that the language was important. If we were to train teachers, we have to speak the language that they understand. So, even in the journal, that came through. The teachers were writing in isiXhosa in the journal. We were explaining things because they are teaching in isiXhosa and we are training them in English. So some things get misunderstood along the way. And lastly, if the management is not aware of what is happening in the classroom, it is very difficult to get teachers to do the right thing because often the management is not sitting in the workshop that we have with teachers. Is not, doesn't know what we're doing in the classroom, and often they do the opposite. So I think when we do interventions in schools, we have to have to integrate our interventions so that they also touch at all levels. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just want to conclude with two things. The one is one of the things we're not talking about in detail is the work we've done with the development of particularly isiXhosa terminology for science and mathematics. We produced in the course of this research two very important dictionaries which are now being used in the Western and Eastern Cape departments of education on science and technology as well as mathematics, bilingual dictionaries in isiXhosa and English. We've also got it in Afrikaans, by the way. And we've got a whole approach to how to do this using the teachers as part and parcel of the development of terminology, and finding what terminology is acceptable, what eventually is understandable and usable in the classroom. That's a very important aspect. And then finally, we've got three key recommendations that I just want to mention. They're all on the in your pack. The one is that we're saying that this research has once again confirmed that unless we put the system in South Africa, educational system, that's the right one, unless we put it on the basis of the mother tongues of the children, and remember I said mother tongue based bilingual or multilingual education, we're not going to make any progress. It's a class issue. People have got to understand this. Only the middle class and the upper class in this country can actually gain from English based education. Not the working class, not the urban and the rural poor. We've got to understand this. If we don't understand this, we're not going to get anywhere with this in this country. The second point is that we need to stress teacher education. This has been done, said by all our colleagues in different ways. Teacher especially initial teacher education and professional development, that needs to be revisited completely. We think the mentorship system needs to be built into the whole approach. We can't go into detail now. And then finally, because of the problems that we experienced during this research with unstable staff situations in schools and to some extent dysfunctional management and so on, we believe it's very important that every district, school district, should have at least one demonstration school where such research can be done and where teachers can come and see how things are done in the best possible way. We think that that would be quite an important development, and there are already such focused schools where which can be used as a basis for further development. And I just want to say thank you very much. The Director General of Basic Education, Mr. Subrahman, made the point that as a result of this 3 hours of research, they've introduced a research in Durban, which will take place every year, possibly every 2 years, where the department, together with the researchers, will interact on a regular basis so that the cutting-edge work that is being done can actually inform policy in a much more direct way. There's much more to say, but I'm afraid for the time we have to stop there. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Jamanda. Was a professor?
Doc.
Thanks a lot. I must, Mr. Brady and the team, we're going into questioning, but I think it's a very comprehensive report that you gave to the committee, and these are things that we need. Because we don't really have the time to go through, you know, do research itself. And whatever is given to us, we can think through clearly and then work on it. Therefore, I was encouraged when I heard Doctor speaking about research in data. Because it's very important that we look at education from different perspectives and then see how it's put into our current policy. With these few words, I'm opening the report we had to questions. I'll start there with Honorable Mufanshana, and then I'll go to Honorable Mkobela, then it's Honorable Lovemore, Honorable Mshwana, Honorable Mshishi, and then I'll just pick up others as we go along, because I see people are still looking. You may start, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. My questions unfortunately won't be as penetrating.
Can I just say something?
Yeah.
Let us cut it down to 3 questions each. Thank you. We'll see as we go along how far they answer the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Now, I was saying by nature of it, any research project, one needs to start it thoroughly and analyze it, and given the time that we have, we can't really critically respond to the research. We need some time. But having said that, we really, to confirm what our chairperson has said, we really appreciate this presentation. We have picked some of what I think are most important points in the presentation. The first one is this community participation, which is very true, that we need to encourage community participation. But looking back as a teacher myself in rural areas, the important figure in that community participation were not parents in our communities, but everything centered around the teacher. The teacher who took everything to the parents, to the community, visiting homes. The teacher would come to my home and find out how certain of his learners or pupils at that time were doing. Now, I know in urban areas, in white areas, for instance, they organize sports and invite parents. this in rural areas can't. My question is, how can this be promoted in rural areas? This community participation, which is being talked of, which is very important. That's the first question. And then on the general comment, you know, one feels really, I don't know, I'm lacking the adjective, but the finding that one, teachers can't or are not in a position to use the assessment tools. It's like a doctor, you know, not being able to use a syringe. What is wrong there? Is this, I know that colleges, for instance, colleges of education were closed. Universities instead are involved now in training teachers. Is your research saying, let's go back to teacher colleges? Are you saying universities are not doing a good job there? What is it? What's happening there? 75, this 75% of teachers not being competent. That's it. That's a, I mean, a tragedy. They are qualified but not competent. Your research, what can be done as a matter of urgency there? So three questions.
Now we
could have
another one.
That one. Okay. Now, the other one is language. Personally, I do agree. But this is tied up with socio-economic factors. You find our own people going for interviews. I mean, people are controlling economy, non-African speaking, what I call it? The English speaking or African speaking, you know, you go for interviews. The first thing is English proficiency. Now, how do we assist in that aspect? Thank you.
Thanks, Chapters. I think I've got three questions to talk about. The first on this presentation, on the program objectives, would relate to the second bullet I have, involving research capacity. In my view, probably within the 5-year period of this research, I'm just wondering whether you have achieved that, necessarily building capacity to various stakeholders in terms of research, and then what is involved in that particular. In the event you have not achieved, what does it mean? How far is that project? I'm just thinking, I'm just wondering if within that we have been able to manage to do that. The second will relate to issues of implementation. Probably your role or mandate might not have gone beyond, but I will have that interest. It's very easy to identify and confirm some of these challenges or problems. To say there's the following problem, that's why they can't write, there's this other problem. It's very easy to identify the actual problems or hindrances, which you have been able to do. No doubt, probably. But then, Chair, I think there's another interesting part, wherein, as you say, perhaps we need to do the following things. Did you look at what may be the challenges in implementing those recommendations? Because it's easy to recommend, but you may find that it's a very serious challenge. There are critical aspects or factors that may even affect implementation. So it's one thing to say this is what you can do, but before you do what you think can be done, there are certain things that will be conducive for this to be done. I'm not sure if I'm driving that one. Perhaps if I were to find a quick example. Okay, let's just go to the language issue. The policy was saying from grade 1 to 3, kids can be taught in their mother tongue. Parents on their own opted for English schools. So defeating that policy of government, until government said, but probably we're not ready to do that. So I'm saying it's one thing to propagate for particular policy direction. It's another if the situation on the ground does not allow that. So you might just come up with a list of recommendations that this is what should be done. But surely it may not be easy to do that from any government has needed that. Each one of those may have particular challenges to implement. Far reach. And I'm saying, did this part or your responsibility look at that to say, other than just do the following? And so that at the end, we don't look at government that is not willing to do certain things when it becomes the environment is not ready. Or you want to do them as if you do not go into certain things and you realize in the course of information that you are not ready to do. I think that point has been driven home. The last part, which should be the third check. Often, unless it's in this particular case, we're saying we're producing our own team or we're making our own team. I would be interested in whether countries, particularly in the continent, which may be facing similar challenges, whether we're able to compare with, to saying we had this country or those countries, they had this kind of challenges. This is how they managed it. But surely we are not the first country to face some of these challenges. So can we compare continental or even international, but I would be more interested in the continent. Yeah, so that, and I'm not saying we mustn't be creative or be initiative to do certain things and come up with the interventions that are South African specific. I'm not saying, sometimes it's not useful to reinvent the wheel when others tried certain things and they failed, and it may be useful to understand how they failed if they are in similar conditions. Even if they are not exactly the same, but they can't be that different to the extent that we can learn a thing or two or avoid certain things in that work. And I think we may need to get into that kind of a discussion either here or sometime in the future.
Honorable Admiral.
Thank you, Chair. And yes, I want to concur just quickly with my colleague. I happened to pick up the headline, and I didn't read the article, but it said Tanzania's efforts at improving literacy rates are paying off.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they've done, but we need to look at that. This is such a complex subject, and so my questions, might be superficial. There just isn't time to go into this in enough depth. I just want to clarify the statement, because it's, quite frankly, and excuse my language, one hell of a statement, to say that 75% of our teachers are incompetent. On what is it based? I mean, I might agree with you, perception-wise, but it's quite a statement to make. And then with respect to multi-grade classes, the Minister has said quite openly, she said to a meeting approximately 3 weeks ago that I attended, that multi-grade classes are here to stay. They're a fact of life and we have to accept them. So they are within her sphere of acceptance. Obviously it must translate into policy support, etc. But they have been around for many years. My own party leader was part of a multi-grade class. Many of my peers were, but they were for small farm schools or small village schools where the class sizes were very small. So there were big differences. I want to know exactly what kind of support you suggest, because you're saying there should be curriculum support, there should be support in terms of materials for the teachers, but how are you going to support? Will the support include ensuring, for instance,
lower learner to teacher ratios. What sort of support would you foresee? There appears, from what I've read, to be a very direct correlation between the principal and his or her management style, the effectiveness of their management, and the performance of the school. When outliers have been looked at, the principal has come out as being one of the determining factors of excellence. And it certainly was mentioned that principals should have certain competences, etc. But should this not be a starting point? I mean, if we're talking about competence tests for teachers, and we have our unions already up in arms because they do not allow competence tests for grade 12 exam markers, are they going to allow competence tests for teachers? I don't think it's going to happen in the current climate in South Africa easily anyway, without a lot of fight. Certainly inspection in classrooms of teaching style is not going to happen easily. But if you have a principal who fully understands the need for all of these things, and can convey that understanding to his or her teachers, it might well happen, and we might well have the outliers might actually become the norm, which we hope, the exceptional ones. I mean. So surely that's where you should start in trying to build this professional civil service for education. I found the figures on the paragraphs the most frightening. This is a fascinating presentation, and the reports are fascinating, but it is the most frightening thing. What is also exceptionally frightening is what was presented to us just now, the fact that as soon as the mentor left the classroom, the teacher lapsed into old bad habits. The principal, to me, can be the only counter to that, and the principal's knowledge of what is going on. Chair, the last question I want to ask is on ECD. I know, but you allowed questioner number one for questions. I'm taking my chances. Chairperson, on early childhood development, it certainly was referenced. The importance of early childhood development was referenced briefly. But it wasn't indicated in any kind of area of specific focus going forward, any kind of, it wasn't one of the major recommendations. Now, I happened to visit yesterday in Grahamstown the Centre for Social Development, where they train early childhood development practitioners. I mean, they're not core teachers at all. And I was shocked to find out, for instance, that, and just for those of you across the table, I'm very new in this portfolio, so I am still finding out. But I was shocked to find out that there is no such thing as a standardized curriculum for an early childhood development practitioner. There is no training provided other than by NGOs. So from one NGO to another, it differs. From one province to another, it differs, etc., each one doing their own thing. Now, that is shocking to me. If we are expecting our children, as was quite rightly said, the child in grade 3 will be... their level of competence will be a reflection of their teachers in grade 2 and grade 1 and going back, etc. Surely ECD should be just as strong a focal point. In fact, it was mentioned in the State of the Nation address as teaching from grade R. It is, however, not a competence of the Department of Basic Education. It falls under the Department of Social Development. Now, I personally would like to see that change, and I would appreciate your views on early childhood development, its importance, and recommendations that you might have. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Allow me to thank the presenters for what they presented to us before I start. I've got a few questions, like there's a limit, I stick to that limit. My first question goes to Mr. Borchardt, if I got the name correctly. Is there any Borchardt?
Yes.
Borchardt. You talked of reading. Actually, working with the community. I wanted to check who you are working with exactly, because you talk of the youth. But then I just to it's important to know the exactly, because if you say use it like very well, who do you work with? And it's like you talked of Eastern Cape, Limpopo, and Gauteng. What informed the choice? Why these three? And if it's anything to do with rural areas, why Gauteng part of that? Because maybe I would agree with Eastern Cape and Limpopo, but you'll explain to us. And then to Sagani, your multi-grade teaching a challenge. You have noticed that, but is there any solution? Because if you find mistakes, or if you as you pick up these challenges, perhaps you should come with a solution. What must be done there? Because it might not necessarily assist much. Without I'm checking if there is a plan that you intend to do to assist. And you did your case studies in Northwest. Maybe the same. Why Northwest only? And then I go to the challenges. The district officials, they are not enough. I think I've noticed that in the whole of South Africa, if we have to say that, somebody was saying he was a teacher. I'm tempted to say I was working with. I mean, I was a teacher, but I ended up working with Sekit. And we don't have enough. Is there a plan to change this? Because, like, it's not only in your area. It's like we don't. And, like, if you speak at the national level, what can be done to assist so that we don't, as you go and find out these mistakes, what is your advice? And finally, Tumtombaza.
Tumtombaza.
Tumtombaza, or enough, ladies. You say that there is a lot of inconsistency among the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm checking. Are we saying we have qualified teachers who are not competent? I mean, I was a teacher. She said nobody could tell me that I was not competent. Because definitely I knew what I did in the classroom. Are you saying these days the teachers, they don't really know what they're doing? Because if they don't, we are sitting with a serious challenge in this country. And also that teachers are not matching their qualification. That's a very serious finding. And what is to be done about it? Because if they don't match their qualification, I mean, you have to be trained to go and teach. But if you, after all the training, it's like it was zero. What is it that you can do to you and I to assist this country? And you use attitude. So somebody spoke of this.
You've got already five questions, madam.
It was two, chief.
No, it's not two. Honourable, and I'm not chief, I'm chairperson. Honourable Mashishi.
Chairperson, I'm not fighting you, please don't fight me.
Thank you, Chairperson. Other question that I wanted to ask has been asked already by my colleagues, but I'll just check on this one that I heard you visited many provinces, and then to those provinces that you didn't visit, what is going to happen because you were not there to find out? And then the other one, I just want to know the relationship with the department. Did you present this research to them, or is the first time that you present to us? And then what is going to happen? And then you keep on talking about learners coming from poor families that are not performing. What is your solution on that one? And then lastly, my colleague asked this one of 75% of teachers not competent. I'm not convinced on that one, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Honourable Smiles, and then Honourable Hanyaho, and then Honourable Mani, and then lastly Honourable Green. I'll take Honourable Smiles, Hanyaho, Matisha, then I'll come up to Mani, and then Zina. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also thank the delegation for a very good presentation. And I think what you have said, all the presenters, in each of what you presented, there are critical stuff that needs to be done. In fact, it's a wake-up call for us as a committee, but also for a wake-up call to look at our oversight as well. I'm not saying that we are not doing well in our oversight. I'm just saying we've got staff now to go back to the department to say, what are you doing about this? That's our job. And maybe we should legislate as well in terms to get right what is being researched and found. Chairperson, the question that I have is with regard to the curriculum and assessment. And my understanding is that it's been found that there is separation. It's not integrated. Now, I just want to know whether you have taken this to the department and said, look, I'm talking head office, not in the departments in provinces, to head office. Why I'm saying this, Chairperson, and please bear me out on this one, you will remember last year when we visited head office, when the curriculum directorate presented, they presented without dealing with assessment. And I said, how can you present curriculum for the whole and you don't deal with assessment? So why do you stop and you say, look for the assessment in another directorate? I said, it's unacceptable. So it's not surprising that you have found what you have found. It's coming from there, and we need to correct it. Chairperson, then the second one is with regard to, on the same one, grade 9. Why did you prefer to take grade 9 instead of taking maybe, you know, those grades that were used in ENA, like grade 6? You prefer to go for grade 9. Then on the writing, Mr. Taylor, have you taken this to the department, the fact that, you know, when we learned that the ENA results with writing and literacy was not good, did you take them to tell them, look, this is the problem, they are writing too little? And then on the promotion one, of the civil servants, I want to agree. You will never get, I'm sorry to use the language, a head inspector those days, which has not come through the ranks, from principal, then to ordinary inspector, then to whatever you want to go. So that one needs some legislation, and it needs support. We need to get people to higher levels of education through a track record. Chairperson, then the last one on the mother tongue. The last one.
That's your first one.
Is it first? Yeah. No, was the others not commenced, Chairperson?
No, there were questions.
Okay.
That's how you catch me out.
All
make
right.
Your comments and it's questions.
Okay, then I will.
Perhaps there's a second bite on mother tongue or someone else. Honorable Ms. Nisha?
No, it's me. It's
me.
That's right. I'm not objecting, it's only that I heard that you said Mr. Khanyao after, yeah. Yes. No, thank you very much, Chairperson. I think when Mrs. Mushwana spoke about qualified and competency, I then said, but there is a problem here. There is a big problem that needs to be addressed. Can you have a person? Because it sounds like you have qualified people who are incompetent. Now the question is, how do you define qualified? How do you qualify if you are not competent? You know, this is, it's mind-boggling. I don't understand it. In other words, is there something that we can put in place to assist us to train competent people to be qualified? Because what it really means is we are training incompetent people. Now, if you train an incompetent person, I don't know. Because if you, for example, think of a screening instrument when these people go into colleges of education or universities, you'll have a problem. Because then, once you screen, you are a gatekeeper. It becomes a problem. But now, is there another way in which we can really identify potential competent people so that when we train, we know we are training once and for all? Because otherwise, I don't know, there's something wrong there. Qualification and competence, I'm getting confused. So maybe just a comment or, you know, what you think can be done so that the number of incompetent people there should be very small. Maybe it could be as a result of burnout. If a person is qualified and competent and then he burns out, he may not seem to be competent if he burns out. That's how I look at it. Just a comment, you know, and a possible solution out of this, because it's a big problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. A comment first. It's a comment, my leader. You know, the past two ministers have raised exactly what HSRC has raised, which then, in my own opinion, is not a new thing altogether. And one will therefore say more has got to be done insofar as the research is concerned. I mean, one spends 2 days really in one's office going through that, and I can say that more has got to be done insofar as what they raised is concerned. Now, the first point, one of the gentlemen raised the issue of Bantu education versus the present education milieu that permeate our country, which is democracy today. Now, if you go, say, to a grade 12 child, will that child know what Bantu education is? That's the question that I'm putting, because you have raised that. Or the very many children, actually from grade 1 to that particular grade, because you are saying Bantu education in this instance, of course, the very many amongst us who are here seated have gone through that. Now, if you then say that that is at the moment a very serious problem among the children that are there in our classes, I don't really think that becomes a problem. And again, there are many teachers who have gone through training after democracy in a country who don't even know what Bantu education is. And you are then mentioning that, and in my own opinion, I don't think that is fact. And if they kindly could take that forward. Number two, the issue of teacher assessment. Now, my question is, how scientific can that be done? I'm saying this because if you go to the schools, the very many the heads of departments, principals, as we call them, have not gone through that particular kind of training. And if you then talk about the assessment and the production of that which has got to be done, they will not know. What we therefore do is unscientific, because you wait for the end of the year and say math children have not passed, English children have not passed, etc. Now, in my own opinion, that is not scientific. Unlike if you go to a company where we'll say that here you are producing apples, you have not done enough. Here you are producing engine, that thing, you have not done enough. I'm therefore saying, because we have raised that particular point, how are you saying that, you know, a proper work can be done to have that attained? We're talking here about the scientific, that thing. If indeed you have gone through that. And last, because you have set three questions, I will present the one really on paper, like I said here, you know, for 2 days trying to look through this. You say that you have gone around to check, you know, the schools. I come from a rural area, there in Limpopo. My wife is a teacher. She travels from our house home to where she teaches on a daily basis, almost 200 kilometers to 200 kilometers back. Now, if you then talk about the access of the you know, all these kind of things, signs, so on and so on, you then have a problem. At the moment, if you, in your assessment of this work that you are putting here before us, look into that. Because if you haven't, then one would rise and say, we still have a problem, and therefore more has got to be looked into. I have more questions, my leader there, Chair, and then I will come back to you, have them presented later on paper. Thank you very much.
I'll tell you what to do with it. Honorable
Bonnie. Thanks, Chair. The teachers have done a good job in terms of covering me in some respect.
Now to my Ms. Kinsey. Thank you.
In South Africa, we had huge numbers of people who did not go to school, and those were called illiterate. I want to understand this illiterate that you're talking about at grade 3. Is it the same, or is it something else? I wrote this: children from rich families are doing better than those from poor families. Did anybody say that?
Yes.
If somebody said it, I would like to be clarified. Of teachers qualified and incompetent. Are we talking about a mismatch between theory and practice, or are we talking about educated people who are teaching but not being taught how to teach?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, my first one would be around the issue of rural schools, education that is offered. As to say, maybe I'm a little bit worried if we'll just use an umbrella approach, as to say, when we talk of rural schools, we're talking of lesser education quality. Because now I think the picture that is a little bit painted is as if rural schools, they do not produce or they do not perform well. It's as if rural schools only cater for poor families, you know, in such a way that for me to have an argument that we need to bring back the rural the rural area directorate. For me, really, I think we still need to sit down and argue and discuss the point very, very much. As to say, are we agreeing as to say that is the kind of education that is in the rural area, and they must even have a directorate that caters for them? You know, don't you want to lift them to the same education that is offered throughout the country? Why should we sit here and argue for them to have a certain directorate, as if we say you have got that level that you must always, you know, but reach that level up until you go to the to another level that is national? It doesn't augur well for me the way we are debating the issue of rural schools. Yes, there are problems of which they are knocking you. I think maybe what we need to do, that is why I say, maybe we still need to have this forum and we discuss more, we debate the issue, where we say these are the problems that they have, how can we uplift them, rather than arguing for another, a little bit lower level for them, and to say they must even have their directorate, they are poor, they are not performing. I don't believe it. I simply do not believe it. even the mindset of the teachers, once we say that they are not well performing, nobody wants to go to the line. I think we are arguing for their territory. Really, really, we're lessening whatever production that you need from those areas. I think we need to change the way we are discussing such issues, Chair. We're talking of demonstration centers. Is it PISA? Yeah, these demonstration centers that they've been talking about around the issues of mentors and whatever. Even there, Chairperson, I will argue again as to say, yes, there is a need for such things, but I would love again if we can have such a discussion saying, what is it that we have right now in our system? I'm thinking that we have got, I know the argument that had, I think it was, I'm very poor in names, I'm sorry to do that, where we say, how do we promote, how do we do our promotion within the system? We've got the principals, SMTs, subject advisors, who are they? Who really are those people? Because now, if we can even come with the concept of these demonstration centers, I think it's quite good, but don't we have... is that not there within our system? We're talking of subject advisors here, we're talking of inspectors. Are we not trying to come with another concept on top of the things that we have, of which we are not well using them, you know? Are we utilizing them to their maximum abilities? We have got subject advisors. I think we should sit here and say, are they subject advisors, really? Are they advising their own? You know, Chair, I was visiting in one of my constituency where there was an outcry as to say, they even say, but our subject advisors do not advise us as teachers. Instead, they look for files. They are file advisors, you know. That's the provision that I think we have. So to come up with another term that is there, I think, can't we sit here and say, what is it that we have, what is provided with us in the system, how best can we utilize that? Because in those demonstration centers, who are we going to use? I think the same subject advisors, because we cannot always use, always wait for NGOs or outside people within the outside the system to come and do these things. We have provided such people. How best do we utilize what we have? I think really we also need to look at that. I was very concerned around the issue of writing, creative writing. I think it is quite correct, though I know even if when you can go out and raise it out there, there will be so many contributory factors as to say, why do teachers will say they don't get time to do such thing, of which is very important. Even they, I think it would be proper for us to look at those factors, like the PPN, the number of learners versus the teacher. Because I'm just imagining a teacher saying, but I've got 80 learners in my class. Do you want me to go through those 80 paragraphs each week? I cannot afford to do it. As to say, yes, we do have these things. I think there's one colleague who has said that, as to say, I think we need to go further, as to say, in our report, let us recommend even more, as to say, we see, but there are factors that contribute to that. Because when it comes to creative writing, really, for the teachers to sit down and mark that paragraph, it takes a lot of time. And it's really needed. If you are fortunate enough to have your child going to these schools, of which I don't know why are you taking them there, whereas all our children must be in these schools that you are talking about. You feel very, very great to see a grade one learner really coming to you to say, Ma, look, I've written this story. And you feel that something is happening to such a learner. How can you best extend it to all the schools? But that is why I say there are so many factors that we need to look at and say, how best can we do this the way that it's supposed to? Oh, Chair, I'll come back on the second round. I see you're looking at me. I wanted to talk. I like talking, but I'll come back on the second round, Chair. Thank you.
I'm not 100% sure about the second round. Now we're going to sit down with him. I'll come to a conclusion at the end. What I want to ask, because quite a number of questions were asked,
When it comes to the sample you did, you looked at education holistically, but I just feel you have to tell me when it comes to your samples, because if you have schools that are inclusive, and I'm not hearing anything when it comes to our special needs, because we have the white paper 6, you know, that speak to inclusive education. And it seems as though when it comes to your sample, we're not hearing anything about those schools. Because within education, we call them the full service schools. And any schools, not any school, there are a few schools that are full service, whether it's in Gauteng, Western Cape, or any province. That's all. What I'd like you to do, when it comes to each group, team, will you just answer the questions you are supposed to, and I'll just knock off as you go along. We'll start with you, ma'am. Thank you.
For understanding the housekeeping of this, we will extend it to a little, we will help us 11. How long?
Just go on, I'll give you start 12 o'clock.
Okay.
We manage it.
Okay, just to say that I mean, education is a very complex matter, and we've tried to present bits of our research in one research that was conducted over 5 years in 1 hour, and certainly it has provoked a lot of discussion and debate, both relating to what research we have done, but also through the broader set of educational issues. We also, what we have written, or the various researchers and consortium members have written pieces in the HSRC review, I'm not sure if you've received that, which describes the research in a little more detail, and Charlotte will send the copies to the secretary and for distribution, so that becomes, you know, a mode to engage deeper in the discussion, and as I said, the reports will be here, will be on our website. We thought this session was going to go to 11:30, and Nick and Sakani are flying back to Johannesburg, and we'll have to pick up a shuttle ride just now. So can I give them a chance to prepare, to do their responses first, and then the others would go? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. My comment about competence versus qualification seems to have stirred quite a lot of interest. At least half of the honourable members mentioned it. A qualification is a stamp you get from a university having completed a certain course. In 1994, 53% of South African teachers were deemed to be qualified. Matric plus 4 years, I think it is. Today, over 95% of teachers are qualified. How did that happen? Short courses, colleagues, part-time courses, most of them the so-called accelerated certificate in education, the ACE program. In 2010, the Council for Higher Education did a survey of ACE programs and wrote the most damning report about it. A competence is being able to do the job. Now, we measured competence indirectly by looking at the SACMEC results from teacher tests. I think you're familiar with SACMEC. It's a Southern and Eastern African Consortium for Monitoring Education Quality. 14 Eastern and Southern African countries participate in SACMEC. It tests learners at grade 6 level, and it also tests teachers. And we looked at those teacher scores. And when I say 75% of South African teachers are incompetent, what I mean is 75% of South African teachers answer those tests rather poorly. They do quite well on basic skills in arithmetic, it's the four operations, they can do addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. But when it gets to bigger numbers, or when it gets to more than one operation in a sum, they fall down. Let alone when it gets to ratio and fractions. And as I said earlier, ratio and fractions are the foundation of all other mathematics in school. Similarly with literacy, teachers do quite well answering simple comprehension questions when they can extract the information directly from the text given. In other words, this is a story about Sari, and Sari is playing in the fields. Question one, what was the girl's name? That's a direct question. As soon as it gets to inferential understanding, interpretive answers, and evaluative questions, our teachers fall down. Now, when I say that 75% of teachers are incompetent, what I mean is 75% of teachers don't have those higher level cognitive skills. And my assumption is, if you don't have something, you can't teach it. So that's my distinction between competence and qualification. There's a glaring gap. How are we going to get there? Implementation questions also came up, starting with my friend directly opposite. How are we going to implement? And a lot of you question the idea of competence tests. I'm not talking about wading into schools and testing 350,000 officials across the length and breadth of the country. That will never fly. And in any case, what are we going to do? Fire them all. What I'm talking about, colleagues, is starting a 20-year program. If 20 years sounds a long time, how long will we have democracy? If we had started then, where would we be now? We need a 20-year plan that goes from one government to the next, systematically being implemented. This is what Brazil did, by the way. Brazil changed governments, they had radical changes of government, they stuck to their plan. And what's the plan? The plan should be to start with beginning teachers. If you can't do maths up to grade 10 level, you can't be a primary school teacher, finish and klaar. Improve the training. Now, by the way, the Funza Lushaka bursaries have improved training dramatically. They've improved the intake of the quality of intake, because now kids are getting full bursaries. They're much better than the NSFAS bursaries. Mm-hmm. Kids are going for them. We're getting more graduates into teaching programs. It's having a big effect, but I think it's a start. We've got to improve the quality of teachers entering schools for the first time. So that's the place to start. And before they can teach, before they're certified competent, you should test them. And that should be a lot easier to do than to bring in competence tests for existing teachers. Secondly, when someone applies for a promotion post, well, can you do the maths? Can you answer inferential and analytical questions on a comprehension test if you want to be an English teacher or a Xhosa teacher? So for promotion, it also shouldn't be very difficult to bring this in. Sure, we're going to have to negotiate with the unions. And by the way, again, I want to say the unions are absolutely key to this. We must get the unions on our side. And they're promising developments in that regard. But colleagues, those should not be difficult steps to bring in. To start bringing competence in with new recruitments and new promotions. And you know what? It'll turn the whole system around because people will then know what they're supposed to know. There can be programs online, training programs, and they can go for them. And then you will get the bright sparks, the leaders, the people who are keen to know, to learn, going for promotion posts. It will change the whole system, but it's going to take 20 years. Colleagues, that's the main thing I want to say. I just also want to say that the question of marking essays, man, you don't have to mark everything your children do. It's much better for them to write and to get excited about writing. And you can walk around the class, you can quite quickly see who's writing and who's not writing. You don't have to mark, you don't have to take all those books in and sit and mark them. You can mark some today and others tomorrow and so on. And pretty soon you know which your bright kids are, who's doing the work, and which ones need help. You know, you don't have to be burdened by that excuse. Okay, let me stop there. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. On the issue of the kind of support that needs to be provided to multi-grade teachers. The report which you have in front of you talks to in detail in relation to this. But amongst those aspects that we think teachers need to be supported around, it will be issues of curriculum adaptation.
because the curriculum as it is meant for monograde classes. Teachers will need to be assisted around how to adapt that to a multi-grade class. And issues of materials, the kind of materials, and also the appropriate languages. Because in some schools, for example, we found that, materials were available, but not in the languages, that especially African languages. So I think, that's the one other area. But also the issue of teaching strategies, which are more appropriate for multi-grade classes. So those are some of the areas where we think teacher support should be focused on. And as I mentioned earlier, currently we only have CPUT here in the Western Cape that is focusing on multi-grade, training multi-grade teachers. The rest of the institutions in the country do not do this. And we believe that that's one other area that needs to be looked at. In relation to the issue of district officials, I mean, apart from the number issue, what I was talking to in particular was the issue of the fact that district officials don't have the know-how to support multi-grade teachers. We know the numbers issue also needs to be taken care of. But I think, what we were driving at here was mainly around the fact that, they don't know how to support multi-grade teachers. And what we are proposing is that they need to be supported as well. So the kind of training that we give to professional development we provide to teachers, we also need to think about district officials so that they are also prepared to support these teachers. On the issue of the Rural Education Directorate, I was thinking about around this is that rural schools have specific challenges, and these have been detailed in the ministerial report on rural education, and we believe that the challenges they're facing could be dealt with if we give them a focus. And the Rural Education Directorate, we felt, was a way that the ministry had begun to use to do that. And it's not so much, okay, yes, we know that rural schools face a lot of challenges, including issues of performance. It's not so much that we're undermining the rural schooling aspect, but to say, okay, they need specific support in relation to their context. And we believe that, we need differentiated policies, policies that are targeted towards these schools to be able to assist them. Straight-jacketed policies don't always help because you're treating everybody the same, meanwhile they're different. And what we're saying is that we need to develop policies for schools, not try to fit schools into policies that we have developed. So that's it.
You may miss that. Who's going to answer next, please? You can go on, Mr. Archer.
Sorry,
Chair. Yes?
Is it Mr. Taylor?
Yes.
Lise, can we ask again, as we've done in the past, that contact details be made available to us? Because there's obviously a lot of questions that we need, that we would like to ask, and we'd like to make contact with the authors of the report. Can Llewellyn make contact details? Would I hope the presenters wouldn't mind.
Yes. I think you should have left that for last, because I got something written down in my conclusion of what we need. Thank you. Mr. Barchett.
Thank you. In terms of the actual sites where the CLING project was implemented, the sites were basically selected influenced by, firstly, the amount of money that were made available for the work, so that was a determining factor. Secondly, we tried to get in a rural and urban bias for the different sites. So that was a second consideration. The third one was we wanted to go to communities where there was a presence of activists doing important political kinds of work. So the sites were selected knowing that there were activists who were known for the work and who we could use as community researchers. So the activists were, some of them were basically just very passionate about literacy itself, or, and some of the others were connected to political organizations, ANC, Youth League, SOPA, a variety. Some of them were linked to the anti-privatization forum and so on. So they were these were considerations that we've used. So we have captured an urban-rural bias, and we have found that these communities are very, very different, and the way that mobilization participation is garnered is dependent on the range of networks of relations that existed in these different communities. The second point is around the teacher's role in these communities, and I think it's a very, very important question. I think the interesting thing is this: we found that in the rural communities, the teachers were far more open to be part of this project, and they were involved right from the beginning. In fact, we had to do some work to balance the power relations, because teachers in the rural communities were ready to take over the project, which we didn't really want to happen, but they were extremely active in the CLING work. The problem was really in the urban areas. Now, the big problem in urban areas is that teachers don't live there. They come to school in the mornings, and the bell rings, they get into their cars, and they leave. So, and this is reflected in the composition of the CLING groups. Very few teachers were active in the work of the CLING, and it is quite directly linked to the fact that they don't live in these communities, and that we found that to be quite a significant problem. But I think we also have to locate this work of teachers, because it's not, I don't think the level of participation in the rural communities is as active as one would imagine it used to be maybe 10, 15 years ago. And I think one has to begin to also understand this problem of the basic assault on teachers over the last couple of years. Where teachers are constantly in the firing line, they're no longer seen as the intellectuals, they are demoralized. These are serious problems for teachers, and the context in which teachers are working is terrible. I don't know of any private school in this country where there's a ratio of 1 to 60. I still need to see how well a teacher in a private school can do with 65 children in a class. It's crowd management. So the point that Nick is raising about the number of paragraphs, you can only imagine with the regime of assessment and surveillance that teachers have to apply within the public education system is undermining the work that they could be doing. So that's I think that's the one, the other point that I wanted to make. In terms of the literacy issue, the literacy, I think it's important that you raise that point too, because remember, we are still sitting with about 14 million adults in our country who haven't completed 10 years of schooling, but that's another discussion that we should have. But the kind of literacy here is determined on the basis of standardized tests that are being set at grade 3 and 6, and based on the results of those tests, the children have been found to be lacking
the necessary skills at that level. So that's where that literacy, how we know about the poor scores. Then the other issue relates to the early childhood development. You're absolutely correct. Early childhood development is, like adult basic education, the stepsister of the education system. It's very, very poorly resourced. And part of the reason why that's the case is because the people who are meant to run these centers are people with very little power. We're talking about women who themselves haven't got 10 years of schooling who are running these centers. And so at the moment, there's three levels of qualifications that exist for early child development practitioners. At NCLEF level 1, which is equivalent of the old grade 9, there's a matric level qualification, and then there's one level at university. But these themselves, there are other structural problems. For example, the Department of Education, the way they remunerate a teacher who is in an early childhood development class falls way short of what they pay a teacher. And even when you look at the foundation qualification at universities, it's not paying enough attention to early childhood development from zero, from the age to 3 months to the age of six. So I think one of the recommendations that I would certainly make is to argue that every single province in a country should have at a university, perhaps, who can work in relationships with providers of early childhood development to establish centers of early childhood development in universities and to look at a long-term program to support, because it's mainly women, with these kinds of qualifications so that they become the intellectuals around early childhood development in this country. So that is what I want to say. Che, if I just may, because I think it's an important point, I want to say something about the teacher qualification story. Many people don't realize that one of the reasons why the teachers that are coming out of our education system now are so poorly trained is also linked to the funding formula of teacher education in universities. Now remember what we see now. We have young people who go into the education system, and remember we are getting the poorest students, in academically poor, who are coming into the education system, who are becoming our teachers. So we have one problem there. But in terms of the funding formula, the way that universities now fund programs is based on the number of people they can get into the system from the first year of university. So what you see increasingly now would be students who are doing a B.Ed degree, in brackets, FET for high school. And what they do is the students start with education from year one and they become biology teachers, math teachers, and so on. But what the problem is, they never spend a single semester in a maths. They don't go to a maths lecturer with a BSc or with a science degree in mathematics. They never go, they don't, biology teachers, life science teachers don't do botany and zoology. As in the olden days. So, and it's because the universities are using this very strange funding formula, because they have to pay salaries of lecturers, they have to gain an income to run their faculties, and this is highly problematic. So one has to really interrogate the funding formula of universities, and we may have to return to programs which we had, such as the BSc plus HDE or PGCE or the BEcon Ed degrees. And in the same line, we also have to look at, for example, and I think this is a point that Neville always makes, is there's not a single university in this country, when it comes to the language issue, that I know of, that
openly argues that the best way to teach language teachers in this country is just to adopt whole language philosophy as the framing theoretical framework to teach them. And that is partly also begins to explain programmatically why we have a problem with literacy in this country.
Thank you. I'll be very brief because time is running out. I just want to repeat what others have said, that to the effect that once you read the full reports, you'll see just how rich the research has been, as well as just how complex the whole issue is. So we've literally just, you know, we've literally touched the ears of the hippopotamus. With regards to whether parents are willing to accept mother tongue-based education, I agree completely with what the colleague said earlier. Most parents think that because English is dominant, and to some extent Afrikaans, English is dominant, their children should be taught in English, and so on. I don't want to go into detail, we all know that argument. The important point is, and this you'll find in our report, is that African languages need to become economically valuable so that parents want their children to learn isiXhosa, isiZulu, Setswana, whatever it is that they want them to learn. Not only African language speaking families, but also non-African language speaking families. Because if you want to become a civil servant and you don't know an African language, you're out. That should be the position. Then African languages become immediately economically valuable, and everybody will want to learn them in the same way that they now want to learn English. So that's the basic socio-economic strategy that needs to be adopted. Secondly, of course, advocacy. I don't have time to go into the details. We went to every single corner of the Western Cape to do advocacy in Afrikaans, English, and isiXhosa, and I can assure you that wherever we spoke, parents accepted that mother tongue-based bilingual education is the way to go. So it's a question of really just making that input. Secondly, I think there's a misunderstanding about bilingual education. I wasn't, unless I've misunderstood, all I was really saying was that because most parents still believe that mother tongue education is equal to bilingual education, it's difficult for them to accept what we're trying to say. And therefore it's really important, tactically, it's really important for people to understand that mother tongue-based bilingual education will make their children competent, proficient in both the mother tongue and English. Not only, it's not either or. Parents must understand that, and as I say, in practice, we've demonstrated that they do understand that, because we can address them as we do in Xhosa, English, and Afrikaans here in the Western Cape and Eastern Cape and so on. Then a factual point about the Department of Basic Education. The Department of Education originally, and later on DBE, was a partner in this research program. From the start, they were part and parcel of the steering committee, which I chaired. They were part and parcel of the steering committee, and in fact, it culminated in the DG of the DBE actually inviting us for a discussion, which led, as I say, to the institution of a researchers in Durban with the department. So they've been completely at EDM, they've been on board all the way right through with this research program, and they know all the details, in fact. And then just on the demonstration schools, I understand the colleagues' concerns about another thing, and I fully agree, we don't want to duplicate things. It's very important that subject advisors who are competent, curriculum advisors, should become part of these demonstration schools. The main reason for making this recommendation is that you can't do research consistently when things are changing in a particular school all the time. You work with a grade one teacher this year, next year that grade one teacher is going to some other grade. You can't continue that work. Or teachers shift and change and so on and so forth, and it's really very difficult to continue doing proper research under those conditions if you want to demonstrate good practice. And that is the reason why we're making that suggestion. It's a very important suggestion, actually. In places like Germany, for example, you've got demonstration schools in every single state. And teachers come from far and wide to come and look to see how particular teaching methods are done in practice. We need that kind of innovation in order to help our teachers to get out of the problem areas where they've got stuck. I don't know whether you want to just add one or two things, would you?
I just want to add on the ECD question. I think, the basis of our work has always started from ECD. So when we went to schools, we started off with grade R, and we went up with the children from grade R to grade 6, for example. And our belief is that children learn to read and write when they are babies and toddlers. It starts from there. It doesn't start at school with grade 1. So I think the department needs to understand that, and it's not paying full attention, I think, in my opinion, to ECD at this very moment. There was some time when we trained teachers in the Western Cape together with ELRU, and the schools were promised that there would be teachers who are well-trained, and 2012 has arrived, and we still don't see ECD programs in schools that are equipping schools and communities. And if we believe that ECD is important, therefore there should be parent programs, family literacy programs that go into community, and community literacy programs that help with parents to understand what it is that they need to do with their children in order to help them acquire literacy at a very early stage. At the current moment, it's NGOs like us, PRIESA, who are working in communities, trying to work with clinics and helping parents to read, and with communities, and we are getting a good response where communities are concerned, and people, competent people coming up who have no qualifications, who want to do this work and who want to understand how young children learn. Perhaps also, I think for me, the highlight of this work has been to get people who are not qualified but who show such competency, and then once you've shown them what to do, they want to do education because now they understand what it is that they need to be doing. So I think it's working the other way around with the work that we're doing in the communities. And to answer the question around the research capacity and whether we have achieved the outcome of building research capacity, I think in the two, I can only speak of our program, PRIESA, and as well as what I know about the CLEAN project, is that the community people have become researchers themselves in the communities, like Ivo has said, and we saw in schools the teachers changing to becoming reflective practitioners in themselves. They did action research in their own classrooms, they planned what they needed to do, they reflected on it, they were documenting through their reflective journals that they are becoming researchers. And once they saw the improvement of their children by themselves, not being told by somebody else, they showed such great interest in the action research on its own. Yeah, thank you.
Just shortly, and then you
answer.
Can
I just finish because she asked a question? Well, you asked about inconsistency when it comes to teachers, and that relates to the take-up of whole language approach in the classroom, and that requires that teachers actually go into the libraries to get books, because for us, a whole language means exposing children to real stories and storytelling, and also it requires teachers to respond to children's journal writing and letter writings. Hence, there was an inconsistency. And because teachers themselves are not readers, teachers themselves are not writers, so it was actually difficult for them to take up those things when the curriculum advisors expected them to bring on children's work that was marked. So, and that was stated in their reflective journals which they've given to us, because they would believe in the strategy, but then the curriculum advisors would want something else. So that was the problem.
Yeah, I think what Pastor Neville said, we worked very closely with the Department of Education, and it was their choice that we do the specific evaluation for grade 9. I think the rationale was that it's done it for grade 3 or 6. and they needed to build capacity for getting assessments for the planned business. And then with respect to curriculum and assessment, we've done two or three presentations for the international, and we have a lot of friends today. We work with them with Anna, and we've been advising them for the need to for the two units to work together. And I hope they'll listen to it. And with sorry about the misinterpretation of what I said about this particular graph. I mean, what I said was that, see, if you look at in every quintile, the poor, the rich kids are doing better than the poor kids. I mean, for every quintile, if you look at it, is that the kids from poor families and the kids from the rich family. So if you look at the trend, if within every quintile, the rich kids are doing better than the poor kids. But then if you look at quintile 5, these are the poor kids. Look at quintile 4, these are the poor kids.
Mm-hmm.
You see, they are not being, they are doing the same achievement for both quintile 3, 4, and 5. So that was driving it also.
I think, as I said before, the engagements between researchers and policymakers and government officials is a very robust one, and certainly we will. I'm sure you're going to suggest ways in which we can have a longer discussion. And so, from our side, doing the empirical work and evidence-based recommendations is something where, for us, it's important to engage with policymakers in order to be able to see the work where they can be useful or not. So we will welcome that. There's a number of questions, and I'm not going to deal with all of them. Just the one thing you asked from a comparative basis, is there any evidence from the continent of something that we can learn from? I just want to refer to one study that the HSRC conducted, and it's a comparative study between Botswana and South Africa with regard to mathematics achievement. And we looked at Botswana and we looked at Northwest Province, and the reason being that, you know, there's just a border that separates the two groups, so we said kind of languages and etc. are similar. And the one finding was that in Botswana, over the years, we've had incremental policy changes. Whereas in South Africa, we do, you know, we just change in 180. We've just had so many policy changes. And that, so there's a great deal of stability in the Botswana education system, and there aren't these constant shifts and revolutions and perturbations. Whereas in the South African system, in the last 17, 18 years, there's constant policy changes and shifts, and there's never a stability, and there isn't any kind of equilibrium for teachers or principals or learners. And it might be a lesson that we should ponder on for longer, before we contemplate the next kind of change we want to make. But at this point, Chairperson, just to repeat the thanks to the whole to yourself and the whole committee for giving us almost 3 hours of your time, and I know your own agenda is further, and we'll be in your hands in terms of how you would like to take this forward, because we also are committed to the idea of how research and policy engage for a better quality of education.
Thanks a lot for that, ma'am. Just to conclude now, I think that we'll need another session. We have to look where we fit you in with another session, because there's quite a lot of questions people would like to ask, and I think we have to have a lively debate on this. What I'd like to say to you, I want to thank you that when it comes to, you know, policies that we have in place. Because I see you took the plan of the department into account too. You know, you acknowledge it. And how can we fit in, you know, this research into that policy itself? When it comes to rural development, I think when it comes to the president, he placed a focus on rural development. and I speak into something that's integrated. Because at within the rural areas, we are supposed to have an intergovernmental relations forum. And education plays a major role in it. So I think a person has to look at what you are bringing into, because it's supposed to fit into that intergovernmental relationship forum within rural areas. Then you speak to community participation. When a person look at what the president said, he spoke about the quality learning and teaching campaigns where you make education. He spoke about education as a societal issue. Very difficult, as you say, bringing in community involvement. But the person has to see how to fit into that quality learning and teaching campaign of the department, because it is there. To me, you know, the way I'm listening to everything, the department has certain things in place. Now, I'm not sure whether I'm using the correct word, whether it's polarized or we work in silos instead of having the integrated approach. And then there's, I think we spoke about this already, there is a need to meet universities, to find out what universities want to do when it comes to our grade 12, or what basic education itself. And how do we fit into their framework? And is the framework that they have, you know, helping us within basic education? I won't speak to mother tongue because it's coming up a lot. But I want to say that when it comes to early childhood development, there is an integrated early childhood development strategy in place. And that we're waiting since last year, because when it comes to social development, they had the launch of the strategy. And education, when they speak to us, say basic education, we are responsible for the curriculum. But we didn't have social development in, you know, within our committee meetings to tell us what are they doing and how are they integrating it with education. Because we know, like I want to speak to the development of the child and, you know, things like that, cognitive functions, etc. So I think that is going to be important. You spoke to the ACE program, and I put here that we have to have a look at it, because it's something that comes from one of the State of the Nation addresses, where the president spoke about that principals have to be trained to be principals. But as I said, Llewellyn will have to look in our program to see when can we meet. Members do have questions though. And I think the questions that you have, send it through to Llewellyn. Llewellyn will send it through to the HSRC. Then at the same time too, what you should do when you reply to us. We have different teams here. Give us who is leading the teams, the names, and you know, all the details, so that if members want to also work with you on a one-on-one basis, they are free to do it. I think that's going to be important. But we have to thank you for being here this morning. We know the session was a bit long, but our program seemed to be cramped, and we want to meet you. That is because we're going into budget from next week, and we wanted to meet you just to hear what have you got to say to us, that we can have different perspectives to, and like the Honourable Smile said, different questions that we can put to the department while we're doing our oversight function. I thank you for this being here this morning, and I think it was very interesting. It's progressive, the work you're doing. And I'm sure, as the department said, let us have in job with you, that they can also look at their policies and change. And then, I like what you said, you know, we think when it comes to matric, our grade 12 results, there's stability within the system. But, you know, we have to look at this policy shift that we are having. Although I believe education is dynamic, it's not static, so things will change. Thanks a lot, ma'am. Thanks, everyone. I'm just giving you a 5 minute counter break because we have to till about 12:25, because we have to look at the state owned enterprises before we leave this meeting. Because the President's office need our, not our support, but they need us to speak to it, you know, as Parliament. And there will be a big debate on it. Thank you. Just 5 minutes, because I also need to go to the Parliament.